First, I want to introduce Howard Kimmeldorf. Howard Kimmeldorf is a professor of sociology and chair of the sociology department at the University of Michigan. He's the author of a number of important books about labor history, including Reds or Rackets, a study of the two longshore unions, West Coast and East Coast, and their different cultures. His other famous book is Battling for American Labor, Wobblies, Craft Workers, and the Making of the Union Movement. And he's going to talk to us today about the legacy of solidarity that comes out of the IWW and the general strike and how it lives on in the labor movement. Please welcome Howard Kimmeldorf.
Good afternoon. I'm very pleased to be here today and to have an opportunity to share my thoughts on the Seattle General Strike and the lessons that it may offer for the contemporary American labor movement. The strike, of course, occupies a very special place in the annals of American labor history. For years, it was regarded as the first general strike in the United States. Other cities, other unions have claimed that title. But in any case, the Seattle General Strike was by far the biggest up to that point in American history. But its significance is not just in its size alone, but in its radical vision. Some of the strikers compared their efforts to those of the Bolsheviks who had just overthrown the Russian government. Mayor Ole Hansen, I don't usually get that reaction when I say that. Mayor Ole Hansen of Seattle, as you saw, took credit indeed for suppressing a revolution in Seattle and then later ran for the candidacy of the Republican Party on that plank alone. The strike itself fueled the state's reputation as a stronghold of radicalism and of labor militancy more generally. Capturing this sentiment years later, a member of Franklin Roosevelt's administration complained in the 1930s that his task was made more complicated because in addition to overseeing 47 states in the country, he had to worry about the Soviet of Washington. In my comments, I would like to begin by briefly identifying what I think are some of the immediate causes of the general strike, and then suggest that this walkout, while exceptional in many respects, was really part of the mainstream of the American labor movement. Specifically, that the general strike displayed a pattern of organization that can be described as a kind of syndicalism, a term that I will discuss momentarily. 90 years ago, almost to this day, residents of Seattle witnessed the largest citywide strike in North America, when 60,000 workers failed to report to work. Historian Robert Friedheim opens his book on the Seattle General Strike with the following description. At 10 o'clock in the morning on February 6, 1919, the city of Seattle was ominously quiet. Buses and trolleys remained in their barns. No smoke poured from the chimneys of factories, workshops, or foundries in the ordinarily bustling industrial portions of the city and its waterfront. On that Thursday morning, even the public schools of the Northwest Queen City were closed. The downtown streets were virtually deserted. Only a few people moved quietly past closed stores and shops. In fear of hardship and violence, Seattle's consumers had long since emptied the store shelves of food and fuel, as well as rifles and pistols. Wealthier families had left the city for a haven in Portland. The first major general strike in American cities, in American history, had begun. I want to begin by asking why this time and why this place? Why this strike took place in Seattle in 1919? There are at least three factors that contributed significantly to the strike at that point in time. The first, as you've already heard a bit about, was the immediate post-war context. The demands of wartime production led to booming economies in war-related industries like munitions and shipbuilding in Seattle and elsewhere. During the war, there were rising costs of housing and food costs in conjunction with a no-strike pledge from the labor movement, which in effect depressed workers' living standards throughout the period of the war. When the armistice was signed, work orders ceased and unemployment began rising. Against this context, employers opened an open shop offensive against labor, trying to roll back the demands and gains that unions had won prior to the war. All of these came together to produce a dramatic spike in labor activity, labor insurgency, and strikes in particular. In 1918, more than a million American workers went out on strike, representing something like 6% of the national labor force. That was a dramatic figure, but a year later, it had quadrupled. More than 4 million American workers went out on strike in 1 year alone, representing an incredible 22% of the American workforce, one out of every four workers going on strike in a single year. The Seattle general strike was clearly an expression of this spike in labor militancy. A second important factor that contributed to the Seattle general strike was the particular nature of the Seattle labor movement itself. In the Pacific Northwest, as you know, was a stronghold of the industrial workers of the world, or the Wobblies, who had large followings in... had and still have, I should say, large followings in the lumber, mining, and shipping industries, and obviously beyond that today. The IWW was founded in 1905 specifically as a radical alternative to the then-dominant American Federation of Labor. The IWW saw itself as a revolutionary union. Its leader, Big Bill Haywood, famously called for abolishing the wage system. In sharp contrast, the AFL advocated a policy that's come to be known as pure and simple unionism, which was to make small incremental demands for better hours, wages, and conditions for their currently employed members. The leader of the AFL, Sam Gompers, was famous for always endorsing and supporting capitalism, which he described as the best system ever developed. Ooh. I'll come back and talk again. For a national organization like the AFL, known for its conservatism, the Seattle AFL was clearly out of step. In 1919, for example, at the AFL's national convention, Sam Gompers was reelected overwhelmingly with only one vote cast against him, and that was cast by the delegate from the Seattle AFL. The Seattle AFL also broke with its national organization in endorsing industrial forms of organization against the wishes of the AFL, which was closely wedded to notions of craft organization that had to be organized along relatively narrow occupational lines. Seattle was also the only city in the country to boast a daily union-supported newspaper, the Seattle Union Record at the time, which drew support not only from radicals in the city, but also the mainstream of the AFL. And indeed, when the Wobblies themselves came under attack locally, the AFL leadership came to their defense, something that would have been unthinkable in almost any other city in the country, given the animosity and tension between the two organizations. As a consequence of this, the Seattle labor movement was unusually highly unified, and it gave a central and strong voice to radicals who were otherwise on the periphery of the AFL. The third and final factor that contributed to the general strike was, of course, the Bolshevik Revolution, which had happened 16 months earlier. Labor organizations around the world were intrigued by the first self-professed workers' government. Long before Stalin, the fledgling Soviet Union offered tremendous hope for workers around the world. Even AFL leaders in the United States sent congratulatory telegrams addressed to Comrade Lenin. The Seattle AFL, as usual, went farther. They sent a delegation to the Soviet Union, both to investigate the new conditions and to offer their assistance. In sum, these three developments, the post-war strike wave, the unified and radical character of the Seattle labor movement, and the international influence of the Bolshevik Revolution, were so much dry tinder. All they needed was a spark, which appeared in the form of a wage dispute in the city's shipyards. And that led to the conflagration that became the general strike. The general strike, then, was a product of favorable conditions at a particular point in time. But, and this is the point I want to turn to now, it was also much more than that. Specifically, the general strike tapped into enduring traditions that have defined the American labor movement, traditions that can best be understood as a kind of pragmatic or practical syndicalism, which I'll describe momentarily. What do I mean by syndicalism? It's a theory of trade unionism that is most closely identified with some of the most radical labor movements in Europe during the first quarter of the 20th century, particularly the French, the Italian, the Spanish labor movements, as well as labor movements in Latin America, where self-described syndicalists were a vocal but minority presence in labor. In the European context, syndicalism has three defining features. First, syndicalists are opposed to the state or the government as an institution, and they are opposed to politics as an arena of action. Now, let me be clear, this is not the traditional opposition to big government that we sometimes hear today from conservative forces. On the contrast, syndicalists drew on anarchist traditions as part of their distrust of centralized power, which appeared to them in the form of the state or the government. Their opposition to politics was based on a view that the process itself was rigged against the poor and the powerless. A second tenet of syndicalism is an emphasis on workers' power being located on the job. And in many ways, this follows from the first point. If indeed politics is a dead end, then the workplace is the route to empowerment. This commitment to struggling on the job is premised on a view of the economic system as being most vulnerable to attack when profits cease, that the collective withdrawal of labor remains labor's most effective weapon. It was this logic of disruption, of course, which fueled the Seattle General Strike. The third and final piece of syndicalism is an emphasis on workers' control that has to be exercised collectively by the rank and file. This is rooted in a profound distrust of leadership, again, part of an anarchist tradition that has skepticism toward union leaders, political leaders, and the like. The workplace, in the traditional syndicalist conception, is conceived as a site where that could be a self-governing society in the future. Without the state, without a government, indeed without elected political leaders generally, workers weren't seen participating directly in their own collective self-government through their workplaces. And again, this vision was realized in the Seattle General Strike to a very great degree when workers not only ran the city, but ensured that essential services were provided for its citizens. Each element of this European syndicalist tradition, the opposition to state and to politics, the building of workers' power on the job, and the pursuit of worker collective control, was present in the American labor movement as well through radical groups like the Industrial Workers of the World. While the Wobblies rejected the syndicalist label, saying that it conjured up foreign connotations and was associated with violence, they embraced a form of syndicalism in practice. First, like their European counterparts, the Wobblies rejected the state and political action more generally. Indeed, their opposition to politics is legendary. A delegate at the founding convention put it this way. "The ballot box is simply a capitalist concession," he said. "Dropping pieces of paper into a hole in a box never did achieve emancipation for the working class." And when the Socialist Party, also on the left but more committed to politics, asked for support from the IWW, they denounced them as the socialists because of their commitment to gradual political reform. Secondly, like the European syndicalists, the Wobblies were committed to worker power on the job. They championed militancy and direct action at the point of production. They refused to sign contracts, which they viewed as a truce in an ongoing class war, and instead insisted on preserving the right to strike when the conditions were most favorable to labor. And thirdly, like European syndicalists, the Wobblies were committed to collective workers' control. And the Seattle General Strike, where workers ran the city, was much of a model for this. In other contexts, the Wobblies exerted collective control over employment, challenging traditional managerial prerogatives, not only over hiring and firing, but even actually organizing the work process. Now I want to push this argument one step further and suggest that this syndicalist orientation, which characterized groups like the IWW, also extended to groups that were the mainstream of the American labor movement, including the AFL. Like the IWW, the AFL distrusted the state and avoided politics. Gompers enunciated his position as nonpartisanship. He felt that politics was the wrong path to follow for working class empowerment, and felt that in any case it would be divisive of the rank and file. The AFL therefore rejected any enduring ties to political parties, very much different from the European model where the mainstream of the labor movements were closely tied to political parties. Secondly, like the IWW, the AFL relied on workers' power on the job. They championed militant direct action and fought individual employers with a tenacity seldom equaled by their more radicalized European counterparts. And third, like the IWW, the AFL fought through aggressive forms of job control. They waged militant struggles to defend the job territory of their current members through restrictive membership rules and work practices. A best example of this might be the building trades, where unions were able to regulate the supply of labor through apprenticeship programs and elaborate formal work rules to protect the existing jobs of their current members. In short, the AFL and the IWW shared a common syndicalist commitment that was based on rejecting the state in politics, relying instead on workers' power on the job, and championing aggressive forms of job control. But while they shared a common syndicalist foundation in general, they also followed very different strategies for organizing workers. The AFL followed a strategy that might be termed business syndicalism, playing on the common term business unionism. This was the syndicalism of skilled workers. It rested on the disruptive power of skilled workers who often occupied strategic locations in the production process and who, because of their skill, were not easily replaced by strikebreakers during a walkout. They could simply withdraw their labor as skilled workers and bring the production process to an immediate halt. The AFL, therefore, was in a position to sign contracts and giving up the right to strike during the duration of the contract, knowing that at the expiration of the contract, they had the power to impose their will on employers. The IWW followed a very different strategy that might be called industrial syndicalism. This was the syndicalism of unskilled workers. It depended on disrupting work when conditions were most favorable to unions. Because most of the followers of the IWW were unskilled workers, they were more easily replaceable. Planned and previously announced strikes were doomed to fail. The greatest weapon was the element of surprise, the need to retain the strike, the right to strike, to act spontaneously when conditions were most favorable. In doing so, the IWW tried to build an inclusive membership that acted collectively and spontaneously when conditions were clearly most favorable to labor. So let me just recap the argument so far. I've tried to make two points. The first, that the Seattle General Strike was a product of a particular time and place. It grew out of favorable conditions, in particular, the post-war strike wave, the special character of the Seattle labor movement, its radicalism, its unity, and the Bolshevik Revolution, which created a spirit of insurrection in the air. Yet the strike tapped into and expressed a more enduring syndicalist tradition. Seattle's workers, after all, avoided politics. They did not seek legislative solutions to their problems. They did not seek to vote politicians in or out of office. They focused instead their efforts on the job by withdrawing their labor. And they exercised workers' control not just in shutting down the city, but in running the city and continuing to provide services for its residents. The second point I've tried to make is that the syndicalist impulse that animated the general strike in Seattle has defined the trajectory of labor in the earlier 20th century and beyond. Both the conservative AFL and the left-wing IWW rested on a similar syndicalist foundation. That is, both organizations rejected politics, focused on the job, and advocated for workers' control. But they did so, as we've seen, in very different ways. The strategy of business syndicalism pushed by the AFL that attracted mostly skilled workers versus the industrial syndicalism championed by the IWW that appealed mostly to the unskilled. In turn, this interpretation has several implications, I believe, for understanding not only labor's past, but its possible future. First, the battle between the AFL and the IWW was not about reform or revolution, as many people have thought, nor was it in any way a referendum on the conservatism or radicalism of the rank and file, as countless generations of scholars have argued. However much Big Bill Haywood and Sam Gompers may have disagreed ideologically about the desirability of capitalism, the rank and file were drawn to the kind of syndicalism that best fit their particular situation, whether it was the business syndicalism of skilled workers or the industrial syndicalism of the less skilled. Secondly, it follows that the AFL's victory over the IWW is not attributable to the presumed conservatism of American workers, their alleged love of capitalism, or lack of class consciousness, contrary again to generations of scholars and pundits alike. Rather, the AFL's victory was mostly a function of government repression of groups like the IWW, employer favoritism of more conservative groups like the AFL, and the long history of judicial hostility to labor in general, and particularly to radical elements within the labor movement. Thirdly, a concept like syndicalism, used as a framework for interpreting the American labor movement, allows us to make sense of its puzzling hybrid character that has baffled observers for decades. On the one hand, compared to organized labor in Europe and elsewhere, the American labor movement is politically weak and indifferent. On the other hand, compared to organized labor in Europe and elsewhere, American workers fight their employers with a level of militancy, violence, and determination second to none. In sum, what most observers see as the political failure of the American labor movement appears as less of a failure when it is seen as part of a syndicalist strategy that explicitly rejected politics in the state while waging bitter economic battles against their immediate employers. And fourth, this syndicalist culture, I would argue, has been quite resilient in the 90 years since the Seattle General Strike. The commitment to militant direct action enabled the organization of basic industry during the 1930s, led by the CIO. The routine militant clashes on the job during that decade, the major strikes in 1934 in San Francisco, in Minneapolis, in Toledo, the illegal factory occupations, the sit-down strikes that erupted in 1937, and continue to this day in the Republic Windows and Doors factory in Chicago. All of these, I would argue, are expressions of this underlying syndicalist commitment. Unlike the IWW, it is true, the CIO did sign contracts, but not in a way that extinguished shop floor militancy. In fact, there were contractually illegal wildcat strikes throughout the 50s, 60s, and early 70s that challenged traditional managerial rights in the workplace. And unlike the IWW, it is true, the CIO, and to some extent the AFL, participated in politics, but not as an end in itself and not as a means of seizing power. Politics was always about expanding worker power on the job so as to increase the organizing muscle of labor, just as it is today in the Employee Right to Choose Act, which is pending in Congress. So looking ahead, what do the next 90 years have in store for us? I believe that these syndicalist traditions provide a foundation for rebuilding the American labor movement. Not the only foundation, but clearly one. In manufacturing, where globalization and economic restructuring have taken a huge toll on organized labor, it's possible to imagine that globalization is something also of a double-edged sword. On the one hand, greater capital mobility clearly does limit the efficacy of local strikes. Employers can simply run away. On the other hand, global competition changes the production process in key ways that can also empower organized labor. Let me just give you two examples of this. One is the development of just-in-time inventories, which are used in many production arenas. This is a strategy of reducing warehouse costs by, in fact, reducing the size of the inventory in various factories. The second factor is increasing specialization of factories across the globe, which leads to their growing interdependency upon one another. The best example here is the global car, which is assembled literally from factories all over the globe. The result of this was evident a few years ago, when a small factory in rural Michigan, some 2,500 automobile workers, went on strike. In a few days, they brought General Motors, then the largest corporation in the world, to its knees. Why? Because there were no additional inventories around the globe, and because this particular factory was producing a vital component in transmissions that was used in almost every General Motors car. So here's a case where, counter to the dominant discussion about labor and globalization, we can see ways in which globalization might actually enhance labor's capacity to resist at the local level. Outside manufacturing, in the burgeoning service sector, workers also enjoy disruptive power to the extent that their services are both time-sensitive and spatially fixed, which is to say that their services need to be performed in one location. They can't be exported overseas. This is true, for example, of the transportation, sales, and recreation industries, where time truly is money, and where the timely withdrawal of labor can be wickedly effective. When buses and trains don't run on time, cities grind to a halt. When maids don't clean the rooms in hotels, when chefs don't prepare food in restaurants, and when clerks don't operate cash registers, business stops, and with it, the profits that are the lifeblood of the system. It is a reminder of that old syndicalist message that labor creates all wealth, and its ability to disrupt the flow of profits remains the foundation of its power. It was a lesson first learned 90 years ago by workers in the city of Seattle. Thank you very much. Wow.